Jack silently thanked the Parademdon, who had saved them from the Tyrannosaurus Rex.
Thank him.
That's right. Annie put the dinosaur back with the other books. Then she gasped. Wow, she whispered, look at this. She held up a book about me.
The Tiger Eye Reading Room is a dedicated space on the ground floor of Townsend Hall on the University of Missouri campus. In the reading room, youth services librarians in training and early childhood educators create story times for preschoolers enrolled in the Child Development Lab program. It's a magical experience that does not translate into statistics or outcome measures or any other quantifiable evaluation system, but it is a microcosm of and almost complete justification for the entire cycle of authorship, publishing, reading, and librarianship. The Tiger Eye Reading Room series of interviews and discussions brings together all aspects of this cycle. We will be talking to authors, readers, booksellers, children, reading adults, and the occasional librarian or two. We'll try and look at all aspects of the world of books and see what connections can be made or different viewpoints expressed. This is Charlie Seavey, and we're talking today to Wayne Wiegand of the College of Information at Florida State University. Wayne is the F. William Summers Professor of Library and Information Studies at that institution, and over the years has issued many, many calls. Some would call them challenges. Some person even called it an angry challenge. The fact that we don't pay enough attention to reading, and which, of course, is what this series is all about. So I'm going to thank Wayne for talking to us today and ask him about this challenge, about reading, and indeed, was he really angry that time?
Well, thanks, Charlie, for having me on the program. But no, I don't get angry too frequently, only when my members of my family are wrongfully accused of things. No, I wasn't angry. It was a matter of concern that the focus of both our research and our curricular attention in library and information studies education was getting too narrowly focused. Maybe a good way to ground what I mean by concern, as you know, I did a biography of Melville Dewey.
Mm-hmm.
And in that biography, the research for the biography, I looked pretty carefully at the origins of the Columbia School of Library Economy. And when you look at how Dewey crafted that school, particularly the curriculum, you realize that that particular moment, it was a historical moment caught in the times where a variety of pressures were exercised on Dewey. He saw a series of professions forming around him. For crying out loud, the faculty members at Columbia were engaged in forming the disciplines of political science, of anthropology, of sociology. So he saw what he was doing as being a particular niche in that mix of professional forces. And he tried to articulate a mission for this civic institution called a library that would not butt up against the jurisdictions claimed by other disciplines. That may be a little complicated. Okay, so here we are with Dewey looking at what librarianship ought to be. And he saw for it what Benjamin Franklin called useful information as its most important contribution to society. That is, organize collections of what Benjamin Franklin called useful information. Now, useful information was a term in the late 18th, early 19th century to distinguish it from fiction.
Mm-hmm.
So here's Dewey talking about curricula that should address primarily its attention to useful information, and you can useful knowledge, and you can trace the vocabulary of useful knowledge directly to the present and how we currently use the term in library information studies, the term information. Okay? So that term information really doesn't take into consideration the reading of fiction, which, if you trace the statistics that go back to the opening of the Boston Public Library, the reading of fiction has constituted 65 to 75% of circulation every year, and that hasn't changed. So, in part, when you go back to Dewey's original school, what you see is he crafted a professional jurisdiction that focused on a particular kind of information, which was exclusive of, did not include an analysis of the reading of fiction, which was perceived to be leisurely, recreational, and they had all those terms, those value-laden terms to attach to it. Well, when I entered the Library and Information Studies profession, I entered with a PhD in social history. And as I watched social history develop about 1980-1985, a body of scholarship began to emerge which looked at the reading of fiction in a much different way than it had been before. It wasn't an elitist perspective that you would find exercised, let's say, by the English faculty of a high-power research institution. It was more, how do people use the reading of fiction in their day-to-day lives, and what they get from it, how do they apply it in the conduct of their day-to-day lives? And I began to realize that the library, if you take this perspective, the library has had a significant role to play in the day-to-day life of millions of people over the generations. So my reason for focusing on reading is conditioned by the definition I give to reading, largely fiction reading, and what I want to do is bring to the attention of the Library Information Studies education and research the fact that this kind of reading has had an essential role in the day-to-day activities of millions of people that we have not focused on, either in our curriculum or very much in our research. How's that?
So what happened here? Let me simplify this or give you my 50-cent understanding of it. Dewey and Franklin were approaching the whole book business from a very utilitarian point of view. I'm reminded of that mid-19th century Society for the Propagation of Useful Knowledge.
Right.
And which is part and parcel of the whole thing. Also seems to me this is all part of, and this is particularly relevant to Dewey, the old progressive era belief that if you brought enough actual information, enough real knowledge onto a problem, everything was solvable, which greatly simplifies that. But so we've been dealing with the legacy of that very narrow approach, and in a sense simply skipping over the fact that our reading public is merrily checking out tons of fiction.
Yeah.
And aren't on the, always necessarily in tune with our professional focus on, quote, useful information. How's that?
That's pretty good. Let me add one more perspective to this. One of the beauties of the establishment of public libraries, the existence of academic libraries and school libraries and even special libraries like government libraries, one of the beauties, especially of public libraries, is that they're voluntary institutions. That means people don't have to use them. They choose to use them. And because they have that influence, I would use a Foucauldian term here, that power, they have exercised a great deal of influence over the years that we have tended to overlook. And I would argue that one of the major influences they have exercised was their continued demand for fiction. And we've ignored studying that. So here they are, applying their own influence to how we conduct these civic institutions we call libraries, and we're not even looking at them. Now, you and I share an important character in our lives. Your dissertation advisor, Doug Schweitzig, who was a colleague of mine for years at Wisconsin, had a phrase that he incorporated into his 1973 dissertation at Syracuse. He said, we tend to study too much the user in the life of the library and not look enough at the library in the life of the user. Well, when you take this perspective of reading and you examine it from the fact that these are voluntary institutions, you can see that the library in the life of the user automatically accelerates that whole human activity we call reading and makes it much more important to the reader than it has been to us as library and information science educators and as library and information science researchers.
Yeah, so essentially the research portion of the library land spectrum of inhabitants, awkwardly worded, but you get the idea, has been essentially ignoring what our own population is doing. And I think to an extent librarians are caught. I mean, line professional librarians out there running libraries are caught in this dichotomy between some of our assumptions about the way things should be and what our patrons are actually doing. I mean, you and I both know there were savage debates about including fiction in the libraries. There have been savage debates about having paperbacks in the libraries. There's an ongoing debate about romance novels in the library. All of these things get read by the ton, and we're still fighting about, you know, there's this continuous battle about what, in fact, actually belongs in a library.
To that, I'd respond that we're at part in fault in LIS education and in LIS research because we haven't tapped adequately into this body of scholarship that would provide us with the kind of vocabulary to explain and to deepen understanding of the act of reading and its social nature. Those both are also components of what happens, why people read as much as they do.
The whole social aspect of it strikes me. What other discipline even looks at that? I mean, it seems to me that the educators, I mean, education people, the early childhood development people must look at reading, don't they?
They do, but they tend to look at it from fairly, I don't want to say, well, I'll say they look at it through a perspective of evolving literacy in terms of mechanics, reading and writing.
Yeah, so it's the process, not the content.
That's how kids
learn to read,
right,
which is a great mystery.
Colleagues of mine at Florida State's College of Information, Eliza Drizang and Melissa Gross, did an analysis of how kids, and I think they were at the St. Louis Public Library with an IMLS grant, they did an analysis of how kids learned computers. And, you know, we have this idea of learning in isolation.
Mm-hmm.
And what they saw was that kids got together around a computer and they learned together.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's how people often read. They read together. As children, you get read to in a story hour, so you're part of a community. Then you read to others. Your mother reads to you and your brother and your sister. You go to church on Sunday and you're read to by a clergy person who gives you the text, and you hear all that. There's an awful lot of community activity associated with reading, which I think is made marvelously manifest in these one book, one city activities.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know the person sitting next to you on the subway who may be reading the same book, and all of a sudden you got a conversation started.
Yeah, it's been a really interesting development watching that kind of grow, bloom, and prosper over the last several years.
Right.
You know, at least Columbia, Missouri was doing one of those a while back. Santa Fe, New Mexico has done at least two that I can remember offhand. You see it in newspapers. It is a marvelous sort of a thing, and it will get people talking.
Right. So my question would be, and I'm not saying this with any kind of anger, my question would be, why aren't we either both teaching this in schools that are educating people to become professional librarians, and why aren't we doing more research in it so that we can help library practitioners better understand what role this kind of activity may play in their service profile, their community service profile.
Let me suggest that reading don't get no respect, and specifically no funding from any funding agencies.
And I won't disagree with you about that, but that, then again, that hasn't stopped the library profession from doing other things for which it doesn't get a whole lot of respect. I would argue it's the right thing to do whether it's funded or not. And if we make our decisions about prioritizing our research attention based upon funding opportunities, then other people are controlling our future, not us.
Well, that's true, but let's put ourselves in the position of a beginning assistant professor looking forward to getting tenure. What's going to get that person tenure and what isn't? What does the divisional committee look at? What do that assistant professor's colleagues look at when tenure time comes?
I'm not hesitating because I don't have an answer for that. I've sat on university tenure and promotion committees. If you trace the our own profession, Charlie, back to the late 1920s, early 1930s, when the University of Chicago was given several million dollars by the Carnegie Corporation to start a graduate library school, you are, as you were at Dewey's Library School, present at the creation of. Historians use that term with some frequency.
Mm-hmm.
And at the University of Chicago Graduate Library School, it emerged from faculty members drawn from departments across campus, largely social science departments. And as social science departmental members, they brought the social science research methodologies with them, and they established those methodologies as the appropriate methodologies to study the study librarianship and libraries. I'm not arguing that social science research methodologies aren't appropriate. I'm arguing they're not the universe. If that assistant professor is educated to be primarily a social science researcher, and he goes to a school where social science is revered more highly than other types of research methodologies among his colleagues, then I think what you describe is accurate. I, however, have sat on a number of university tenure and promotion committees, and I realize that there are different research methodologies that apply to, and I'm going to divide the university in three broad categories. They apply to the humanities, the social sciences, and the sciences.
Mm-hmm.
Humanities faculty members have different ways of looking at similar research questions. And a good university will respect their ways of looking at them as they will respect social scientists' ways of looking at research questions as they will respect science's research methodologies. That assistant professor, if well acquainted with humanities research methodologies at the graduate student level and if supported by a faculty that is multidisciplinary in its approach, and at an institution where humanities research is celebrated and acknowledged, that assistant professor should not have second thoughts about engaging a study of romance readers at the Tallahassee Public Library.
Is there such a study underway, Wayne? You pulled
that
one out of your hat there.
Not that I know of. A tragedy I see is that a good share of the scholarship on reading is absent analysis of the reading that takes place in the library. And over the generations, the library has been a major player in creating communities of readers.
Mm-hmm.
So on the one hand, you've got librarianship and LIS researchers and educators kind of ignoring reading. On the other hand, you've got reading scholars kind of ignoring libraries.
Yeah, yeah, very true. You raised that issue. You know, you and I were at that American Studies program years ago in Omaha, and there were at least three papers there, as I recall it, where I thought, gee, you know, they had a public library in the town in question, and I'll bet some answers could have come
right
out of there. So, yeah, there is a lot of I don't quite know what it is. It's a it's so obvious, it's transparent. I was looking at the ALA meeting in New Orleans. There was a Cambridge University Press had something about a several volume encyclopedia of democratic institutions or something along that line, and it didn't mention libraries at all. And I thought, what's the point?
Go figure.
Yeah, I mean, it may not have been Cambridge University Press, but it was of somebody of that ilk, of that level of prestige. And I thought, how can you have a democratic culture and or what purports to be an encyclopedia of a democratic culture and utterly ignore the public library as an institution?
Yeah.
It just mystifies me completely.
At the ALA conference, Charlie, you may have picked up one of those little trifles that the ALA Office of Research and Statistics puts out. And year after year, there generally are a few statistical comparisons that they push. And I really like to call upon those. The first one is there are more public libraries in the country than there are McDonald's restaurants. Whenever I say that to people outside library information studies, their eyes get real big.
Yeah,
they never realize how broadly spread these institutions are. Then I follow that usually with two-thirds of the American population frequents the threshold of a public library at least once per year. That also tends to get them. Then I follow that with, of that two-thirds, 80% go to the library primarily to check out a book. And that continues, in ALA survey after ALA survey, that continues to be the number one service that people want from their libraries. And this is especially the case for service for their children. They want those programs. So, again, you got the public exerting pressure on this institution for a service that we tend to have been ignoring in library information studies. And the reading scholars of the world also have tend to been ignoring to be ignoring the library.
Yeah, to loop back to something you said earlier about the two-thirds of the American public walking into a library once a year, and you noted earlier that, 60-65% of everything that goes out a library door is, in fact, fiction.
Yeah.
Okay.
Actually, I said 65-75%.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's an enormous number of books.
Right.
That's a huge number. People read the stuff, and somehow, it's all under the radar. It's under the researcher's radar. It's been, to a large extent, under our professional radar. Although, my sense is that that's changing across the last 20, 25 years. We are this series we're doing is partly paying attention to reading. A couple of my colleagues, Linda Esser and Denise Adkins, have gotten a grant from the Romance Writers of America. To do some, talk about getting no respect. One of the other interviews in this series, a woman named Rexanne Becknell that had some very, she's a romance writer, had some interesting observations on the topic. What curricular change, let's talk about the master's level first. What curricular change would you like to see, recommend, whatever, so that schools of library and information studies can maybe put a little more oomph behind the whole fact that this is what people do?
Well, you know, I'm not king of the universe, and I don't get to declare what what happens. And I try to be a cooperative partner with my colleagues wherever I'm teaching. So I don't get to do what I want, but if you ask me to design the utopia that I perceive, I see the need for a core course in which students are exposed to the literatures and scholarship on the social nature and the act of reading. That word reading must be defined very broadly to go way beyond the mechanics of literacy.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's got to be divorced of elitist tones that have been plaguing our profession for generations. Quite often, let me give you an example of a word we still have in our vocabulary, serious reading.
Mm-hmm,
okay?
Mm-hmm.
Where did that word serious come from? Nina Baim wrote a great book that focused on women's fiction that emerged in the 1820s, 1830s, and 1840s. And what she saw in the reviews of that fiction that emerged from the pens of men was that they distinguished between the fiction they liked, i.e. male reading, as serious fiction, and the fiction they didn't like, i.e. female reading, as mere reading, M-E-R-E. Now, we've lost the word mere, but the word serious continues, and we apply that to a particular kind of fiction.
Yeah, and it is an elitist kind of a thing. You know, you and I have knocked around, you introduced me to, I think, the whole idea of reader response theory, and that what is important to the reader at any given time may be exactly the content of the book, even if it's abysmal trash fiction of some kind.
Yeah.
And that in that sense, it is serious because that's what the reader needs at that point in time and place.
Right. One of the things I've tried to emphasize over the years is we have to take popular reading as seriously as the readers do.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
we haven't
yeah.
done that.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, I keep coming back, and I've been hammering some of my classes for several years now, is explain to me the amount of romance novels that get bought, and the figure is in the billions.
I believe 55% of paperbacks sold in the United States last year were categorized as romance.
Wouldn't surprise me in the slightest. And okay, the public is speaking with their pocketbooks here. And anything the American public is willing to spend money on has to be taken seriously. Why aren't we looking harder at that stuff? I mean, I've read a couple of romance novels, and oh, dear me, I couldn't do it.
No, for me, they're ether in print. I just, you know, but that's because I bring a different set of intellectual bags with
right,
me.
Right, right, right. You know, and yet, I mean, these people get denigrated, and yet here's the American public consuming the stuff by the bushel load.
Mm-hmm. And libraries are churning it across their circulation desks.
Yeah, yeah, at the ones that are smart enough to have it in there. And yet, as a profession, I'm really not sure that we take it at all seriously. It's maybe half a step above comic books, and I could have some things to say at that, but we only got about 4 minutes left here, so maybe I'd better not. yeah, this serious, and it seems to me that that's an inherently, serious reading is an inherently elitist notion about what the dead white guys wrote, maybe. I don't know if that's...
We've expanded that since the beginning of the 20th century, certainly, but the word serious still categorizes a particular kind of literature, and I'm not denigrating that literature at all. I'm just saying we have to open up our understanding to all literatures, especially the literatures being checked out of our libraries.
Yeah, it seems to me if we could do, and I'm sure the data are out there somewhere. See, I'm showing my social science background here. we could certainly identify in broad classes what gets circulated. You know, if we could take that 65-75% of the fiction that walks out the door, I'll bet we could pull some categories out of that. You know, the romance stuff, the science fiction, the fantasy, the westerns, goodness knows, mystery novels. You know, do we differentiate amongst those? Probably not. It's all probably lumped under fiction. You know, which also goes along with the New York Times bestseller list and all that sort of thing. So maybe we need some of that social science research, Wayne, to show us where the weight is and all that.
Ironically, the users have developed a vocabulary to distinguish subgenres within each of those larger genres. And we haven't applied our own rules and regulations governing the organization of, quote, information.
Right.
We haven't applied those words to the way we organize those materials.
Yeah.
So it's there. We simply haven't piggybacked onto it.
There are, I did see somewhere recently a book on assigning subject headings for fiction. So there's some of that. Now, one of the other things that came out of the interviews I did in New Orleans, all the authors, all the fiction authors, were talking about the tremendous amount of cross-boundary of shifting gears between mystery and romance, and mystery and vampires and romance, you know, all this stuff. So maybe even some of the old hard categories don't hold true. It's a constantly evolving sort of thing.
Yes, it is constantly evolving, and I would debate that these categories ever were hard and fast, one against the other.
Yeah, you know, Mickey Spillane and some of the early potboiler writers might disagree with that, but I think probably in the last 30 years, yeah, there's a lot more of that cross-genre and genre shifting and all that. So, well, Dwayne, Jen tells me that we're starting to push the time limit really hard here. I want to thank you for being with us. We could easily go on for an hour, but the power that controls the switch over there won't let me do it. So I'm looking forward to seeing you this fall, and do think about designing your ideal curriculum down there.
Thanks, Charlie, and thanks for having me on your program.
So ends another session in the Tiger Eye Reading Room. Come back again for more interesting and, we hope, provocative discussions from the world of books, reading, writing, publishing, promoting, care and feeding in a library. You know where the schedule is posted. See you next time on LIS Radio.